Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our fifth look at the Cult of Matamoros. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for the Deathcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, follow the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows. And for the second level tier, you can get access to exclusive content and series, just as my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did, as well as my largest Patreon contributors monthly, Debbie, Betty, and Matt. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax, grab something to drink. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last week. The cult had made inroads in Matamoros and had insinuated themselves into the Hernandez brothers' drug-running group. We left off with the cult celebrating the holidays in Mexico City and Adolfo causing an issue between Sarah Aldrete and another one of the female followers by telling this other follower that Sarah was, in fact, his wife, and that was the reason why he could no longer sleep with her. On December 27th of 1988, something happened which many within the Hernandez organization did not think was possible, and that was for the oldest surviving brother, Ovidio, who had been a holdout in accepting Constanza as El Padrino, or the patriarch of the drug smuggling organization. On December 27th, Ovidio and his wife and children had traveled down to Mexico City, where Ovidio was officially brought into the fold, undergoing a ceremony during which Adolfo carved his mark upon the older man's back and shoulders and officially made him a Rodeo in the cult. Throughout January, very little happens that is out of the ordinary for both the cult and the Hernandez clan. However, in February of 1989, Elio and Ovidio are in a local cantina where they encounter a small-time drug smuggler by the name of Ezequiel Rodriguez Luna, who informs the brothers that he has nearly a ton of high-grade marijuana for sale. While the brothers try to play it off that they're not interested, very shortly after Luna leaves the bar, the two brothers also leave, heading back to Rancho Santa Ana, where they reach out to Constanza in Mexico City. And very quickly, Constanza arrives back in Matamoros. We know that he was there on February 14th of 1989. Very quickly, a meeting is set up between Luna and Constanza. We know that a time and place was set at a nearby cafe, but that Luna never arrived there, instead being grabbed off the street by three members of the cult and whisked away to meet with Constanza at the ranch. Constanza ends up cutting off three of Luna's fingers as well as a nipple, more out of enjoyment than out of necessity, as Those who were present later stated that Luna was ready to tell Constanza everything he needed to know about where this stash of marijuana could be found after the first digit was removed from his hand. He learned that the drugs were held at a place called Rancho Caracol, which was about 50 miles southwest of Matamoros in the town of La Pesca. They learned from Luna that two individuals were guarding the stash of drugs, that both of them were armed. When they arrived at the ranch about an hour later, Constanza led the charge, brandishing the Federale badge that he had gotten from Salvador the previous year. The two men, who saw before them a well-dressed individual with a police badge, followed by eight heavily armed individuals, quickly surrendered. We know that these two men were brought back to Rancho Santa Elena, where they were forced to dig graves. After this, Constanza is said to have asked his followers whether or not they should cut them before or after he kills them. Without waiting for an answer, Constanza then opens fire with a silenced MAC-10 machine gun, after which the bodies were savaged by the other members of the cult, with various parts being removed for use in the Ganagana. And it's only after placing the men's remains, the brains, hearts, and various other small pieces of their bodies, and Constanza has performed a ritual, that the cult returns to the farm that is an hour southwest of Matamoros and retrieves the bales of marijuana. And it appears that the group sat on this marijuana for a period of time, until on February 23rd, Constanza announces to the cult members that they need to have another sacrifice immediately. We know that the first individual that they grabbed on that day started screaming from the back seat of the car, and that Constanza ended up ordering the man killed then and there. After they disposed of his body and Constanza's car was cleaned, the cult set out once again, looking for a suitable sacrifice. Not long after this, Constanza sent out a group of men to find them another sacrifice. This turned out to be Jose Luis Garcia Luna, no relation to the drug smuggler that they had previously killed, who was walking down a dirt road towards the family's hovel when Constanza's men arrived. Jose was brought before Constanza, who instructed Elio Hernandez to do the actual murder. Elio ends up decapitating the young man with the first strike of the machete. It's said that after the decapitation, Elio realized that something was amiss, and looking into the face of the victim, informed Constanza that the young man was in fact his cousin. Those who were gathered said that a scene of weeping then occurred as Ovidio and Elio began crying helplessly at what they had done, while Constanza ignored them, proceeding with the removal of the top of Juan's head so that the brains could be removed, before ordering the others to drag the body over to the Nagana, where the remaining blood could be poured into it, and other parts of the victim's body could be used for the sacrifice, and to feed the dark spirits that dwelt within. We know from statements of those who survived the end of the cult that Constanza made Elio cut Jose's heart out from his body, along with his lungs, after which he and his brother were both made to skin the skull of Jose, and that these actions seem to have burned away any remnants of emotional detachment that they may have had for their now deceased cousin. The next day, Jose's mother walked and hitchhiked her way into Matamoros proper, where she filed a missing persons report on her son, only to be told by the constables that her son more likely than not had fled the region into make a better life for himself. However, his mother did not believe this, stating that Jose was not the type of young man who would just take off like that without informing his family of what was going on. The day after this, the entire family went out looking for Jose, before eventually returning to the police station and being told that no missing persons report had been filed on their loved one, and that it was too late in the day for them to do so now. They would have to return the next day. So the next day, Jose's mother returns to the police station, arriving before they have even opened, only to be yelled at and mocked by the officers when they, in fact, do open their doors to the public for arriving too early and for not believing them when they told her that her son had simply fled to the United States. The officers refused to take any sort of information about the boy and roughly throw his mother from the police station. She would later tell authorities that she knew her son had not gone to the United States and had in fact been taken by someone. As February bleeds into March, the city of Matamoros is overrun with tourists, specifically college-age students who are coming south of the border to celebrate spring break. This infuses the local economy with a lot of much-needed money, but also can lead to situations where tragedies can occur. Constanza had gone back to Mexico City, returning on March 10th, at which point he is alleged to have told his followers that the police cannot touch them now. It is also alleged that he told those gathered, including little Seraphine, that not only were they invisible to the police, but that their bullets could not kill them, so long as the blood magic was in place and the Nagana continued to be fed with new souls. Now that part about being invisible is actually going to, in part, lead to the cult's downfall in the coming months, as some, little Seraphine in particular, took El Padrino's words literally and would begin acting even more brazenly than he previously had been. More importantly, however, it appears as though at this point Adolfo Constanza was beginning the spiral, which is so common among serial offenders. That point in which they begin to honestly believe that they are untouchable, to the point that their actions begin to mirror the chaos inside of their minds, and they begin acting without thinking. This fits the profile of an individual like Constanza, who has always been a social outcast, and having discovered this new wonderful thing, murder, that gives them power over others, it fairly quickly became an obsession and compulsion with him. But there were other aspects as well to Adolfo's killings. While we've discussed at length how he manipulated and controlled his followers, during many of the murders that were committed, Adolfo would not only subjugate the victims to torture, both psychological and physical, he would also rape them. And a key aspect of this can be found in the fact that almost all of Constanza's known victims were in fact men, and that the men seemed to have bore the brunt of his rage and frustration, whereas the women were killed almost out of hand simply because they happened to be there while he was in the midst of one of these blood frenzies. So there is a sexual aspect to the act of murder with Adolfo Constanza, which needs to be explored more. We know that he was a homosexual, that during this point in time, homosexuality, not only in the U.S., but also within Latin communities, was looked down upon. So that, coupled with his upbringing, created this void inside of Constanza where he always felt less than other people. Even with the magic that his Pilaro had taught him as a child, as the man molested him, there's almost certainly a feeling inside of Adolfo of being less than other people, despite the cold, confident airs that he put on to his followers. We know from surviving members that when it came to sexual intercourse with women, it was perfunctory. It was simply get it over with and done, whereas the males, he took great pains to degrade and humiliate them, bend them to his will so that they would satisfy his sexual desires, giving little care to their own desires and needs, something that was mirrored in the murders that he committed, the acts of sexual sadism that he inflicted upon his victims, really show us an individual who was consumed by the desire to control, degrade, humiliate, and dominate the victim wholly. So it's with this in mind that we turn to the events of March 13th of 1989. Constanza is back in Matamoros from Mexico City. He is told by old Serafin that there is a possible buyer for the marijuana that they had stolen the prior month, but that it's going to take a week or two for all of the details to be ironed out. Constanza, who is living an extremely lavish lifestyle, as are those who are closest to him, consents that this is okay, and turns his attention to his bloodlust, letting his followers know in no uncertain terms that they need to have another sacrifice that night. And from records that we are able to access, statements that were made by those who were present, by this point, Constanza has given up any pretense of giving a reason why they need to commit a human sacrifice. He simply states that it must be done, and his followers rush to obey his commands. According to testimony later given by the survivors of the cult, they found their victim outside one of the many bars that the Hernandez family claimed as their turf. He was a low-level drug dealer, an unknown individual to them, who was out selling cocaine to the spring break revelers. They grabbed him, brought him back to the ranch where the torture began, However, something strange occurred during this assault. Once Constanza had the man inside of the hut alone with him, the other members of the cult realized that not once during their entire assault had the man screamed out in pain or terror. Constanza had noticed this as well, and he had progressed to the point in the torture of skinning the man alive, though there were still no shrieks of agony. Instead of the sacrifice they had wanted, this murder, in Constanza's eyes, was a bad omen, and he demanded that his followers go out and find him an American. Some accounts state that his followers promised to do it the next night. Others leave the exact wording that Constanza used as ambiguous. What we do know is that on the night of March 13th, a college student by the name of Mark Kilroy was down in Matamoros with a group of his friends, Bradley Moore, Bill Huddleston, and Brent Martin. They had traveled from Santa Fe after all of them met up from their respective colleges and had spent the previous day partying in and around Brownsville and in Matamoros. We know that on the night of March 13th, they had predominantly drank inside of two bars, one called Sombreros, known as the London Pub, both of which were considered the territory of the Hernandez family. We know at some point Kilroy left the bar with a young woman before eventually coming back inside when she informed him that she had to leave, that this was roughly at around 2 a.m., at which point the four boys began their walk back towards Brownsville. Later, the young men's recollections of what happened would be somewhat hazy. They stated that they were walking in a sort of shambling, loose group, and that at some point they passed a short Mexican man wearing a blue shirt who some of them believed had said something to them in English. However, none of them could be sure with absolute certainty. We know that William Huddleston stopped around this point in time to urinate before rushing to catch up with his friends. And it's at this point that someone realizes that Mark Kilroy isn't with them any longer. Obviously, this startles the young men, but at this point in time, in the condition that they're in, there is very little they can do. What none of them know is that Mark Kilroy has encountered Little Seraphine and one of the other followers, that they have grabbed Kilroy, thrown him into a brand new pickup truck, and raced back to Rancho Santa Elena. And in doing so, they have blown through a police roadblock as Little Seraphine believed that because of El Padrino's magic, they were invisible to the police, and that the police would not only not be able to see them, but that they could operate unhindered. And it's this turn of events that is eventually going to be the downfall of the Cult of Matamoros, as the police decide to follow the red truck, and instead of rushing in to arrest the men who were driving it, they simply stop and wait, watching, although not really sure of what they are watching for. They all know that this particular ranch is home to the Hernandez drug family, and that drugs routinely pass through the property. According to Little Seraphine, quote, "We were riding around. It was like 2 in the morning, 1:30 in the morning. We were going toward the bridge near Garcia's. We were riding slow, And Malio told me stop, and I heard Malio say, "Do you want a ride? Do you want a ride?" And Mark said, "Yes, yes." Mark said, "I'm drunk. I'm so fucked up. I drank too much." I forgot what he said exactly. Something like he wanted to go to Silverado's and drink some more. We said, "Okay, but let's go take a leak first. We've got to use the restroom." Kilroy agreed to this, and the two men had their unknowing victim. According to Little Seraphim, the men did in fact stop to urinate, and at this point, Kilroy, who had gotten out to urinate as well, sensed that something was wrong and tried running from them. Seraphim went on to recount, "We were using the restroom, so we couldn't chase him." However, Kilroy ends up running into another group of El Padrino's followers, who had been driving behind Little Seraphim in a blue Chevy Silverado. Seraphim stated that the other two who were inside of the Silverado jumped out and screamed freeze, and that Kilroy, who was heavily intoxicated, believed that the men were police. He stops, puts his hands in the air, at which point the men are able to corral him back into the Silverado, and the group are able to continue on their way unmolested to the ranch, passing through the police checkpoint unmolested. And somewhere during the course of the trip, Kilroy ends up being bound hand, foot, and mouth with duct tape. Now, Little Seraphim stated that once they arrived at the ranch, he removed the duct tape from Mark's mouth, and Mark became panicked, at which point he went to great pains to assure the young American that nothing bad was going to happen to him and that he would be released unharmed. After which, according to Little Seraphim, he gave Kilroy some crackers and water, and then the four men left the young American still bound in the back of the truck, heading off to their own homes. Upon arriving at his apartment, Little Seraphim contacted Sarah Aldrete and informed El Madrina that they had done as Constanza had wanted. She told them that this was good and that everyone should meet back up at the ranch the following day. Now, one of the individuals who actually lived at the ranch later told authorities that the following morning he fixed a plate of eggs for Kilroy as he felt sorry for the young man, although his sorrow was tempered with the fact that he did not wish to draw El Padrino's ire. This individual, named Domingo Reyes Bustamante, said that once he had finished feeding Mark, he returned to his shack, not wanting to see what was going to happen. Little Seraphim said that he arrived at the ranch at around 12:30 to find that everyone else had already arrived, and that Constanza, Elio, and Martin were all inside of the shack with Mark Kilroy. Seraphim gave this account to authorities. "It was quiet. We were outside. Then all of a sudden we heard a sound like when you slice a coconut. Bomb. At first we thought it was a coconut. Then we stayed outside a little bit longer, and Adolfo came out and said, 'Go in there and take him out.'" Seraphim said that they had heard no sounds of anguish from Kilroy. Police would later learn that the young boy had been castrated as well as sexually violated before Constanza cut the top of his head open and removed his brain, which was then placed inside of the Nangana. According to Seraphim, after the followers had looked at Kilroy's body for a few moments, Constanza handed a man by the name of Dubby a machete and ordered him to remove kill Roy's legs. It was said this individual, Dubby, was worried at first, but by the time he finished removing Kilroy's legs, he eagerly cut out Mark Kilroy's heart and hefted it up to El Padrino as a gift. As with the first sacrifice that had been committed in Matamoros, Kilroy's spine was removed and set to become a necklace, after which his remains were tossed inside of a shallow grave and covered over. What members of the cult did not know at this point in time, however, was that Mark Kilroy was not just some American college student. Kilroy came from a fairly well-to-do family, and his uncle Ken Kilroy worked with U.S. Customs out of Los Angeles. With his connections, Ken Kilroy was able to get an investigation started into his nephew's disappearance. This investigation is going to see members of American law enforcement break numerous international laws as they attempt to discover what happened to Mark Kilroy, with numbers of them going over the border into Mexico unannounced to look for the young man without the foreknowledge of their contemporaries inside of Matamoros. And this is eventually going to cause some issues further down the line, but at the moment, as investigators are trying to retrace Kilroy's movements, recreating the crime a dozen times or more, officers in the U.S. came to the conclusion that, given the state that Mark Kilroy was known to have been in at the time of his disappearance, it was almost a certainty that he had been picked up by some corrupt police officers intent on trying to get a ransom from him, roughing Mark up in the process. This same theory held that during the initial beating that the police gave young Mark, someone probably got a little overzealous and Mark ended up dying. There were a number of factors the police based this on. First and foremost was the statements that Matamoros police gave, saying that Mark Kilroy had absolutely crossed back over the bridge into Brownsville, thus making it a U.S. problem. Secondly, they could find no witnesses who had seen Mark beyond the four friends he had gone down to Matamoros with. And based upon the condition that those friends said Mark had been in the last time they had seen him, he was an easy target for individuals looking to do him harm and possibly make a quick buck. Lastly, the police took the fact that they could find no evidence placing him anywhere in Matamoros after his disappearance, i.e. inside of a jail cell or in a drunk tank, as further proof that Mark Kilroy had met a grisly end at the hands of police officials. At nowhere during their investigation did anyone stop and think that it may have been drug smugglers who had in fact grabbed Kilroy in the hopes of ransoming him off. As to the best of authorities' knowledge at this point in time, Americans were usually off limits to drug smugglers, and based upon the fact that they had had no contact from anyone in regards to Mark, it seemed highly unlikely that a group of criminals of that nature had taken him, nor were they hearing any rumblings of such a group existing from the various informants that they had on both sides of the border. This led Mark's father, James Kilroy, to increasing levels of frustration as the man had left his home in Santa Fe upon news of his son's disappearance and remained in Brownsville, night and day during the course of the investigation. Mark Kilroy's disappearance drew a lot of attention, much more than Adolfo and his followers had believed would occur. The disappearance of Mark Kilroy at the border was plastered all over American news programs such as America's Most Wanted, as well as across newspapers, both nationally and internationally. Police later said that with this massive media attention, they started to get a lot of tips coming in. However, unfortunately, none of these panned out. Eventually, Mark's father, James, is going to put up a $5,000 reward, while the businesses in and around Brownsville chipped in another $10,000. So big did the investigation become that helicopters, both state and federal, began flying up and down the banks of the Rio Grande, looking for any hint as to Mark Kilroy's fate. As the end of March approached, Brownsville authorities were able to arrange for Bill Huddleston, who claimed to have seen a swarthy-looking man with a scar on his face just prior to Mark's disappearance, to come back to Brownsville, where they arranged for him to go to the Matamoros Police Department to look at a series of mugshots. Now, according to one of the officers present during this meeting, the Matamoros police officers pulled them aside and basically flat out told them, you know that this is a drug deal gone bad. Obviously, something went wrong during the drug deal and the dealers took Kilroy hostage. If you will simply give us an hour alone with this young man, we'll get to the bottom of it. However, the Brownsville police refused the offer. By the time April rolls around, Mark Kilroy's case pretty much becomes active, as there were a lot of other cases that needed the attention of local authorities. Even so, flyers of Mark Kilroy continued to be posted all around Matamoros and Brownsville. According to police in Matamoros, one of those who volunteered to post flyers of Mark Kilroy was none other than El Madrina herself, Sarah Eldrete. However, we have no concrete evidence stating that this was in fact the case. As for the cult itself, according to surviving members, during this point in time, although Constanza was concerned with the amount of attention that Mark Kilroy's disappearance was garnering, he read the cards and the shells and told them that he could sense that law enforcement was groping blindly towards them, yet had no way of pinning them down. As he is reported to have said a few days after Kilroy's murder, quote, they search everywhere for him, and they still cannot touch us. Constanza's followers took this as gospel, proof that their Padrino was in fact all-powerful, and that his magic was in fact real, and could protect them from the long arm of the law. However, to others, such as Dubby, Martin, and Sarah, he confided that he still felt an ill omen over the death of the man who would not scream, and that they should all keep their passports ready, just in case they had to flee quickly. The Hernandez family is eventually able to find a buyer for the marijuana that they had stolen, and in preparation for this sale to a Houston drug ring, Constanza decides that they need another sacrifice. It just so happened that in the days and weeks preceding this, Sara Eldrete's former boyfriend, the low-level drug dealer, had come crawling around again, which did not go unnoticed by the other members of the cult, who all told Sara that the man needed to go before Adolfo got wind of it. Sara did not seem dissuaded in the slightest, and some have said, in fact, she began interacting with the man more and more. When Constanzo finally did learn about it and confronted her over it, Sara is said to have told him something to the effect of, "You don't care if I'm with any others, why should it bother you if I'm with him?" Those words, Sara sealed the man's fate, even though she protested at first. On March 28th, Sara Eldrete agreed to bring the man, Gilberto Sosa, into the clutches of the cult, where he was taken prisoner and brought to the ranch. As with the other victims, Sosa, too, was tortured mercilessly, sexually assaulted by Constanza, and had his throat slit, at which point his body was draped over the beams inside of the hut, thus allowing the blood inside of his body to completely drain into the Nagana. 2 days later, the gang made another sacrifice. This time, an individual by the name of Victor Saul Sauceda. Sauceda had been marked as an enemy by the cult, as it was said he was searching for Dubby with the intention of killing him. Sauceda, a former Matamoros police officer, was said to be the hired hitman for a man who was reputed at that point to be the godfather of Matamoros, Juan N. Guerrera. At this point in time, Victor had taken to hanging out in the various bars that were known to be hangouts for the Hernandez family, often deriding them and downplaying their religion as something of a joke. The evening of April 1st, Victor was driving around a residential area in Matamoros, staking out one of the many safe houses that the Hernandez family had in the area, in the hopes of coming across Dubby. Victor ends up being picked up by two Matamoros police officers who informed him that the chief of police wanted to have a word with him. Unaware that Constanza had paid these officers to entrap the man. According to Little Seraphin, who was one of the men that took possession of the now bound and gagged Victor, the entire time they drove to the ranch, Victor kept saying, "Don't you know who I work for? Who are you guys? What is it that you want from me?" Unlike many of the other killings that took place, we know that Sara was present that evening of April 1st. According to reports that later surfaced, it was Dubby himself who began the assault on Victor inside of the shed. As with Mark Kilroy's family, Victor's mother put in a missing persons report and put flyers all over the city of Matamoros in the hopes of finding her missing son, all to no avail. On April 8th, the drug deal went down as scheduled. However, there was a small hiccup. The following day, members of Constanza's cult were picked up by authorities as drug smugglers before the money could be transferred to Constanza. Word of the arrest quickly spread throughout the gang. After speaking with some of the other gang members, it's reported that Constanza then reached out to Sara, and she met him quickly at the bridge. Once ensconced in the hotel, they made a number of plane ticket reservations to both Mexico City and to Florida. As the group headed towards the airport, Sarah Aldrete realizes that she does not have any of her identification, nor does she have her passport with her. Constanza cusses her out loudly before ordering that she be dropped off at the bridge, reasoning that it would probably be best if all of them traveled separately anyways, and giving Sarah instructions to meet them down in Mexico City, at which point he and the other members of the cult who have avoided police detection drive off into the harsh Mexican sun. We're going to end this week's episode at this point. I hope that you guys have enjoyed our fifth look at the Cult of Matamoros, and we will be back next week with the final look at this particular case. Until then, stay morbid.